This is a little preface to the following set of tapes, which are being made on, I think it's the 15th of March, now the 15th of April, 1999, at approximately 4:17 p.m. is when I'm starting. And read by Goblin Hood. Just a minute. Yeah, the 15th of April, 1999. It's now 4:18 p.m. I've been waiting to do this now, not knowing if I was gonna do it for most of the month, I guess. Goblin Hood Satyricon is a unpublished novel written in 1995, and of all the things that I've put on tape, figuring Biotti'd like to listen to this kind of stuff when he's trying to paint the kind of stuff he's trying to paint, this is probably the most pointed, the most like what he'd want to be listening to. In a sense, all of the paintings and stuff that he's doing now on his own represent more or less elaborate illustrations for Goblin Hood Satyricon, or at least they're all based on the novel. For instance, the center panel of Sweet Sodom Apocalypso, the triptych, is called A Bugbear in Sodom. That's directly from the novel. So nothing in the paintings is actually point-to-point corresponds to the novel or anything. It's all just like vague retellings of the same stuff. In fact, once you know, listen to this novel, or once I have to read it now, it's going to become increasingly obvious, I think, that it's hard to say what it is saying. But anyway, the reason I'm doing this little note is to state this. I finished typing the novel, I guess it must have been early in 1995, it was spring, probably around April, so it could be seen as like maybe 4 years ago. I read it once, right after I typed it. Or Biotti did, you know, and went back and corrected one section, I remember, because I had left some sort of major, you know, plot hole there, you know, something that just wouldn't parse, had to be fixed. So Biotti did that, he retyped one page, or fixed it, or something. Now, the novel is, I'm absolutely sure, full of errors and mistakes. One that I've noticed is that I was numbering the pages in order to make a copy for a friend of mine, and I missed out a page, so that there are actually two page fives, you know, that kind of thing. There's also a point where the first time the typewriter ribbon that I was using ran out, I didn't know what to do, and somehow I started a new page from that point. So that constitutes in the TypeScript most of a blank page that isn't supposed to be there, as opposed to other large ellipses perhaps that maybe are. The novel is also written in a strange way. The first part is fairly straightforward, given those ellipses or whatever. The second part is told from a different viewpoint. Instead of the first person, it's like the second person or something, or the third person or whatever. And it's told in a series of little vignettes. Instead of just like a continuous narrative with chapters, it's like just one long statement broken down into little, you know, statements, sub-statements. I'm not sure how, when I get to it, I'm going to suggest the space between those statements. And I'll probably just do it by a pause. There's a lot of, like, playing around with, you know, language and stuff, and there may even be some, you know, like, I know for one thing, there's one whole chapter that I believe is blank. That was meant. It's just like, chapter whatever doesn't have anything in it, and it's not supposed to. It'll be read that way. So in other words, the reading of something is different from the reading of it onto a tape is different from reading of it into your mind. And so this is going to have to, like, make whatever compromises it has to make. As always, it's goblinhood reading the typescript here onto tape. But Biotti is supposedly speaking in his own voice, at least for a while. So let's just get on with it. It's like going to be, I'm still going to be doing it sometime tomorrow, I'm sure. So I just want to be finished, because this is the biggest job that I've had to do yet, probably the biggest job I have to do. Reading the Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch barely prepared me for this, since that, at least, is a book that I've read over and over again, whereas this, however, I may have written it, you know, I've only actually read it once in its completed form. It's not my purpose here to edit or revise the typescript. I'm just going to go with what's here. If it ever gets published and Biotti wants to change any of it, he'll have to, you know, deal with the fact that there's also a tape reading, a tape recording of the actual original version. So that's assuming that the tapes all survive and whatnot. Anyway, I think that's about all I have to say. There will be frequent stops here. I just can't do too much of this at once. But I have to remind myself, too, that this is so much easier than typing it. Anyway, the last time I read this was sort of a magic time for me in several ways. I don't expect anything like that now, and, you know, I'm kind of leery of generic magic, but if I don't know what the results of it'll be, I don't really want to mess with it anymore. I guess I'm getting old. But, anyway, for what it's worth, here we go. Tape one. Goblinhood Satyricon, a novel. Copyright 1995 by James Biotti. Read by Goblinhood. Part one. A Warlock in Sodom, or The Cry of the Nocturnal Goat Sucker. 1. There were no devils, only entities within freaking, shrieking distance of that ribald metropolis, or so I kept trying to tell myself as I rolled into town. I'd had to walk halfway from Mars to get anywhere, and now I stopped to puke on the sidereal sidewalk because I'd had no sleep for what seemed a year, nor any food either. To my confusion, I wound up in an ordinary gutter, retching beside an ordinary Midwestern small-town sidewalk. But I recognized this place. I even recognized the state I was in. People were edging away. Even the gutter rats were holding their noses. I was in pretty sad shape all around. This couldn't be me, I felt, viewing myself objectively. Nor did it really seem as if I belonged where I was. Or was I only just discovering the parameters of my true country? Whatever. There was business to transact here. I'd come of age now, so I had to visit a local ministry and register for the death lottery. It was the law, as the ad says. Back on the street, I thought I'd blow some more chunks. Just tell them it makes its own gravy, that little old inner voice of mine quipped. Disgusting, snap. The Duchess of Pink Polyester, standing hard by. Since no real answer was required, I had plenty of time to wonder who she was. Nobody. Why she didn't just go jump in the lake. No particular reason. And, most importantly, what was causing me to think in obscure terms such as hard by, which remained a total mystery. But as she spoke, millions were biting the bag in the death lottery. Another opaque concept, to my mind anyway. Still, I couldn't wait for my turn, if only to clear out of this cheesy little burg which pompously called itself Beautiful Free Mountain, in French yet. Anyway, having reached my majority, as they say, I tried to formulate big plans for the future. No dice. The best I could do was to plan a raid on a local soda fountain. I wanted an egg cream, an almost vanished confection of yesteryear. Though my exact motive for that escapes me now, unless it was to go outside and spew it on the sidewalk or on the fat lady's pink shoes, if she gave me half a chance, but of course she didn't. And so matters stood, while I sat outside the drugstore trying to keep that gunk down, perched atop a trash receptacle like a big public toilet, feeling like the Lord of the Gutter Snipes with decorative vomit festooning my tasteful late summer ensemble, pretending I was somewhere else and wondering what the fuck to do now. Mars was too far to walk anymore, and the stars were growing restive on me. Good thing I couldn't see them through the perfect cerulean sky, but I could smell all my enemies converging like jackals and vultures on this point in space and time. I'd used up all the slack around here. Living outside can make you do that. Hell, nobody ever really liked me anyway, but that's no reason to register for sitting on that fucking trash can forever. At least not when real goals might spring to mind at any minute. At that moment, for instance, I wanted some action, and I needed to find a place where magic would really work. That narrowed things down some, but I had it all planned out, or so I kept trying to tell myself, though I couldn't even think beyond the next 5 minutes. Too wasted. A bus was coming down the road just then, but so what? That crappy egg cream had left no coin on me, nor had I any true destination in mind. Or so it seemed. I only had a ringside seat to watch it cruise past. No great spectacle, I guess. But then, empty, dizzy, sick, and without visible means of support, I myself made a pretty sight, and I felt even worse than I looked. Bitter gall and bile roller-coastered up and down my throat, and old man headache was parting the cheeks of my mind for an ungreased rim shot. And just how long could I maintain my tenuous position here? An interesting question, soon to become moot. like so many other burning questions of the day. As it happens, I was just projectile vomiting some sort of weird greenish-yellow fizz from the end of the line when matters resolved themselves at the hands of local townspeople and villagers, the same bunch who were always chasing the monster around in Frankenstein movies. Only this time they were brandishing a free bus ticket to anywhere but here. The further, the better. Preferably Mars again or some other dimension. Nice to feel wanted, I muttered inwardly from the grate outside, but I was used to this quaint response. I never liked it here anyway, I blurted out loud, dutifully and sort of relievedly, collapsing and folding and otherwise disposing of my brief career as a public eyesore, say, that locale. The road beckoned, and I was prepared. My black bag of tricks was always with me. And not magic, exactly, but just a kind of sleight of hand, or even just sleight of mind, depending on how one looks at it. I even had some friends or associates, or even, perhaps, familiars along with me, hiding out in that duffel. A very resourceful bunch they were. And my shadow, Goblinhood, he was always around as the past leaked into the future. And so I hopped aboard the bus as that polyester soap brain barked, and this time, stay out. At least I can't get kicked out of the death lottery, I mentally consoled myself, another part of me wondering just what the hell good that did me. Does this bus go to Sodom? I asked the driver, who was, strangely, very difficult to focus upon. I and Gamora, he affirmed, as we pulled away. I watched the bitchy housewife recede as we booked down the road. She could have been my mother, but so could any hostile woman from my vantage point, outside of everything. No rites of necrosha could prevent my mother's grim haunting of me. I should never have killed her, not even psionically. I should have killed myself instead, or even committed mass suicide. Just think of all the problems that could be solved by such a decisive move. Yeah, get rid of all the bastards, muttered the demented reptile back there in my skull. Cripes, can't you keep your psionics in your pants for even a little while? Jabbered Goblinhood, sotto voce, afraid that I really meant it. Besides, Apocalypse never solved anything, he went on persuasively. It would solve one problem, I smirked. The one about what to do with all that barf I left back yonder on the sidewalk for them folks back home. Amidst my snickering, G.H. mumbled something about the polyester dragon taking it home and having it bronzed for her grandchildren as some kind of object lesson or something. He was wishing we were back on Mars, his favorite turf, hanging out with the Sidonian Sphinx. I was wishing it was 10 years or so earlier so I could chain smoke on this bus. But as I furtively surveyed my surroundings, I noticed it was now more like 30 years in the past, as of this writing, which meant there was no smoking anyway, because this was no hound of the road, but was instead a little yellow school bus that I used to ride in circa grade 5 or 6. In fact, I even knew what day it was and what I was here for. The devil, I ejaculated aloud, harvesting some more disgruntled villager-type glares from my fellow travelers. But then I remembered there were no devils, only entities, for as far as the mind could see. 2. So there I was, barging around in the deep past, hoping I wouldn't get stranded back there in the late 1950s with my familiar dolls and my ludicrously occult clown suit. I'd hated that era the first time around and didn't hanker for a return engagement. But I had an important mission at hand. I didn't know what the rest of the folks on the bus were doing, but I was riding home from school and slobbering over a library book on loan to our rural school system just for me from a big city library where they probably kept it under lock and key, constantly guarding it with their lives. I'd surprised the local school librarian with my unpleasant erudition by requesting a book of horror stories by H.P. Lovecraft, and this was as close as they could get to it at that time, even in the big city. It was an omnibus horror anthology containing two of H.P.L.'s choicest yarns. I was only 10 or 11, but I'd read about Lovecraft in a movie monster fanzine, and in fact, I'd already even read one of his stories about doomed Sarnath in a paperback anthology of heroic fantasy tales. Now I was going to find out about his Dunwich horrors and the rats in his walls. I never dreamed at the time that I'd be getting religion over this stuff, but looking back, I can recognize that with perfect hindsight. And so Howard Phillips Lovecraft, safely tucked away in his Providence, Rhode Island grave for decades, could still sort of wander merrily around, supposedly introducing people like me into a much scarier world than they knew anything about. But in fact, my experiences as a former Christian made H.P.L.'s little cauldron of horrors serve up like duck soup with a soggy piece of cake floating pointlessly around in it. Alone and irrelevant, unnoticed by and practically invisible to the indifferent, vastly alien and monstrously frightening elder gods and great old ones of Lovecraft's pantheon, I could feel almost as snug as a bug in a rug on drugs, secure in the knowledge that the gods didn't care. The only sin in Lovecraft's so-called Cthulhu mythos was being stupid enough to meddle with the gods, and thus attracting their attention or otherwise earning their scrutiny. But in the Judeo-Christian continuum, you could and would be tortured forever just for not believing whatever crock of shit some self-righteous dickhead with a Bible was braying on and on about. And there were so many conflicting dickheads to choose from. Then, too, Lovecraft's gods, for all their eldritch horror, seldom actually managed to accomplish anything much, usually being thwarted in their weird plans by some doddering but plucky and unpleasantly erudite librarian or antiquarian with some knowledge of these occult matters. Yahweh, on the other hand, couldn't even be destroyed by crucifixion and was, moreover, known to have gotten away with destroying entire cities over their sexual orientation and the like. For that matter, Yahweh had already just about destroyed the world once and was threatening to finish the job any day now. Yahweh was, in fact, so fucking scary that I once considered converting to Jehovah's Witness just to get out of going to Yahweh's hell, that eternal playground of the damned, choked and swarming with losers who couldn't believe in Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, or Jesus the Friendly Ghost. Verily has it been said that Yahweh put the fear in the fear of God. But then I learned, through unpleasantly erudite ways and means, that one could believe in anything at all, given enough time and incentive. Just look at some of the crap people do believe, without even wanting to. And it was this arcane knowledge which enabled me to blow Yahweh's shitty little universe for good, I hope. In fact, I bailed right out of the Einsteinian space-time continuum before I could get kicked out again, and set up shop in a much larger world with access to other dimensions, some of which, admittedly, were a lot crummier than ours, as witness my last little sojourn. That was how I could be en route to Sodom now, because in an alternate reality, just a few doors down the Matrix, there was no stiff-necked, psychotic prude of a god to vaporize errant cities. In this other universe, Sodom went on to become a sort of world capital for gutter snipes, grubwarts, and sleazebags of every stripe and denomination. It was the only town I knew of where the mainstream citizenry was maybe as repulsive, dissolute, and downright creepy as I was. And it was said, by whoever says such things, that Sodom was a place where magic really worked. 3. Meanwhile, the stodgy little yellow bus was still trundling pointlessly around the dusty back roads of rural Ohio, circa 1959 or so. But my business back there was concluded now, and I wanted the detour over with, knowing better than to directly challenge the awesome authority of an almighty bus driver, I opted for subterfuge. I ducked behind the seat in front of me and climbed into my mask. And so, once again, goblinhood was made manifest, because this looked like a job for goblinhood. And sure enough, the other passengers flipped right out, and half of them shit their pants from the smell, and all just from the old gobster even quietly being there. Hell, that nebulous bus driver was almost as creepy as goblinhood, if not far creepier and more inexplicable. But clearly, this latest anomaly wouldn't do. Seeing how matters stood, and probably fearing mutiny on the part of my restive fellow passengers, no doubt resulting in the violent seizure of the bus, if not outright ritual sacrifice of the driver, and perhaps even a reversion to cannibalism. Aware of all these grim possibilities, the driver shifted gears or something, and we rolled right into town, as if nothing had happened since page one. Next thing you know, goblinhood got kicked off the bus. I'd rather travel by pogo stick anyway, thundered Goblin Hood bravely after the bus was already gone. Famous last words, I muttered as I removed the mask. I wanted to try and save GH for emergencies, just in case any should happen to emerge. So there I was in Sodom, where, supposedly, magic really worked. Feverishly anxious to begin tampering with things best left alone. I knew from my extensive travels that my first move should be to hop in a cab and ask to be taken to a cheap hotel so that the cabbie could drive me aimlessly all over town, most likely winding up back near here, and eventually charge me 20 or 30 pounds of flesh and expect a tip into the bargain. But I also knew that such cynicism didn't become me, and besides, I didn't have much luggage, let alone any cab fare, so I figured I'd just play it by ear for now. Meanwhile, I was famished from not having eaten during this millennium or so, and from having spit up everything in my stomach, including stuff seemingly indigenous to said organ. But like I just said, I had no money, nor even a pet to piss on. So I brought out my familiars from their familiar digs in the bag, hoping for some good luck. Though dolls, or poppets, as the good folks of Salem used to put it, these intrepid little travelers were much more adept at solving this kind of problem than I was. And sure enough, in almost no time I found a 10 spot in the gutter and went scampering happily into a nearby supermarket after replacing my diminutive but stalwart companions in their bag to buy some non-perishable pre-cooked grub. And a funny thing happened to me on my way out of the store. 4. I was standing at the checkout counter, third in line, with my groceries. Donuts, instant coffee that I could make at a hot water tap, sweetener in packets, M&Ms, cigarettes, and other staples. As always, I hated standing in line and was anxious to be gone. Suddenly, a dwarf came into the supermarket, stewed or stoned to the gills, and evidently spoiling for a fight. And he didn't, by God, care who the hell knew it. Not all dwarves are like this, of course. Hopefully only a few are. But I may, in my wanderings, have met most of that few. I've also known some really good folks who were physically challenged in that way. But this guy was a textbook example of someone exploiting his own tragedy to intimidate others, especially the normal people around. It's really hard to argue with a frothing dwarf, especially if everyone else just wants the problem to go away. Not that I meant to argue or try to resist the guy's hassling, but I couldn't help wondering, what if I, a crazy person, acted like a belligerent dwarf just because I'm crazy? What kind of a world would that be? And could I even get away with it? The dwarf got in line behind me, toting a family economy-sized package of toilet paper, looking like he planned to wipe his ass non-stop for a solid month. The package was almost as tall as he was. Had he not been such an obnoxious prick, there might have been some kind of pathos here. But it's really hard to empathize with the pain in the ass, you know? Anyway, the guy's next move was to strike up a conversation of sorts with me. First, he informed me that he wasn't going to be wiping his ass after all, but instead planned to throw this stuff all over people's houses and front yards. That figured. Next, he insulted my groceries, my sunglasses, and my long hair. Though irritated, I correctly interpreted his largely incoherent mouthings by letting him slither ahead of me in line. At that point, I noticed the name Barbarossa stitched across the back of his jacket, so I began thinking of him as Barbarossa instead of just the dwarf. But I still didn't like him. Then Barbarossa started in on the attractive young woman ahead of us in line, who had been keeping abreast of the proceedings. I don't remember what he bothered her about, but after only a few of his practically indecipherable sallies, witticisms, and bon mots, she took the hint too and stepped behind him in line, exchanging a significant glance with me. The first person in line was a young Oriental man whose groceries were already in the process of being rung up. And here there was a problem. He couldn't sacrifice his place in the middle of the transaction just to appease Barbarossa, and everybody knew it. Confounded but stubbornly determined, as if being a shithead were his job or some kind of sacred trust or something, Barbarossa began haranguing this unassuming young fellow, wanting to know just what kind of an Oriental he was, anyway. "I'm Korean," replied the first customer in line. Barbarossa jumped on that revelation with hobnailed boots, demanding an explanation of North Korea's aggressive nuclear research program. The same in any universe, it seems. The Korean groped for words. Everybody was embarrassed for him, and temporarily wished, no doubt, that there weren't any dwarves or something. But I felt that something had to be done, and that the situation was too good to waste, I guess. And so I yielded to temptation. Briefly turning my back, I assumed the spidery visage of goblinhood, that damned, demented, drooling derider of everything everyone holds dear. Whirling about, goblinhood cried out, "Damn straight," about whatever Barbarossa had last said. Then, half lunging and gesticulating at the Korean, sort of scooping the air like Rotwang showing off his robot in Metropolis, goblinhood raved, "And by the way, do you people still eat dogs?" The silence following this amusing jape was pierced only by goblinhood's patented, high-pitched, macabre cackling. Following that, the poor beleaguered Korean abandoned his groceries and fled. Goblinhood, of course, was immediately kicked out of the store, sans groceries, and even threatened with the cops. An idle threat. Nobody wants to get that mixed up, even with a dwarf, much less with something like Goblinhood. Besides, I later found out that there weren't any cops, as such, around. And so I was still hungry, but it was worth it to see the look on Barbarossa's face when somebody deliberately weirder and even more obnoxious than him crawled out of the woodwork to join in the fun and to upstage his berserk antics. Tired and half-starved, G.H. sat down on the curb and wished he still had anything in him to throw up. He was suffering for his art. That good old egg cream of yesteryear seemed like something from ages ago, and was at least 40 or 50 years ago, depending on how you reckoned it. I'd signed up for the death lottery under duress during the early fall of 1969 in a small town a few universes away, and now it was sometime during the 1990s via the late 1950s. Time sure flies by night when you run out of fun. And TH had definitely had enough fun for one epoch. Just ask that poor Korean. Five. And so, even though he was desperately hungry, but too sick and spaced out from not sleeping to really want to eat anyway, Goblin had just sat there, gaping stupidly into the gutter as if a square meal might simply drift by. Instead, the gutter reminded him of where he was by being ankle-deep in shit-stained condoms and empty KY jelly tubes. But as he sat there, risking it all, as usual, on the death lottery, it occurred to him to wonder just where all the wild perverts and orgiastic sensualists were, anyway. The streets were dead. "They only come out at night, Kemosabe," said an unexpected voice. This turned out to belong to the woman from the checkout line, Barbarossa's second conquest. Her casual use of telepathy served to remind G.H. of the city's other claim to fame, in this dimension anyway. "I like your style, masked man," ironic bow. And then, whipping off the mask, I introduced myself. Surprisingly, Bella Madonna ignored the dried vomit all over my clothes and invited me to her home for coffee, donuts, M&Ms, and cigarettes, or whatever, and to see her etchings. As soon as I eagerly said yes, we were there, rapid transit having evolved to extremes in this place of magic. The possibilities involved in all this excited me to no end, and I was really glad that no fucking malignantly deranged asshole like Yawa was around to stink things up. The great old ones were supposed to be around somewhere, of course, and they really do stink, but they're much too lofty and too busy with whatever their agenda is to give a sweet shit about what all the minuscule and insignificant sodomites are up to. Things got even more overtly Lovecraftian when it turned out that Bella Madonna really did have etchings. Her own work, in fact, like some Cthulhuvian artist from a lost race, she had presented all kinds of pertinent information about the city in her detailed images. And though Lovecraft has been castigated widely for his so-called adjective-itis, it must be admitted that the hideous and eldritch quality of certain things going on in the benighted lost race murals that his characters had to interpret in stories like The Nameless City and At the Mountains of Madness, these imponderable qualities, I say, were often useful in papering over obvious gaps in logic, and were even, occasionally, the only factor which could account for the character's successful interpretation of such profoundly alien art. Anyway, I studied Bella's etchings while she went off to the bathroom or someplace for what seemed like a really long time. One piece included a map which represented the overall domain of Greater Sodom, sometimes called the Protectorate of Sodom, as covering all of the civilized world. It remained unclear what was contained by the other, much larger part of the planet, though I somehow pictured it as a great forest with the words, "Here there be dragons," emblazoned across it on a banner or something. The old town itself was quite large and was divided on the map into four sections, not unlike Baum's Land of Oz, I guess. Roughly one quarter belonged to men, most of whom seemed, from certain eldritch indications on the map, to be gay. Another quarter was for women, who ranged, as near as I could tell, from gay to bisexual to something else only darkly hinted at, as HPL would say. A third ghetto-like area seemed to have been grudgingly set aside for breeders or heterosexuals, without whose sterling efforts, of course, the species would die out someday and the city be depopulated or reduced to artificial insemination or cloning or something. I later found out from Bella M., who was very knowledgeable about this city, let alone unpleasantly erudite, that the Korean man G.H. had recently encountered probably hailed from this district. She said she could tell by his mannerisms. The fourth quarter of the city was simply designated Other. But I could tell by certain hideous, eldritch, Lovecraftian clues that this section of the city harbored outsiders of every stripe and denomination, sexual or otherwise. I figured it was probably where I'd wind up, given the rigid sexual categories which seemed so implicit everywhere else. I'm practically celibate myself, though not necessarily by choice, which would make me a real perv around these parts, while goblinhood can best be described as variously queer for women and willing to settle for inanimate objects if they're feminine enough, meaning that he hangs out with an oddly adapted sex doll called Maya, which he actually seems fairly devoted to and which has long since evolved beyond its original purpose. Pornography, too, has taken on a special meaning for this daffy sexual pioneer. At that thought, I inspected Bella's bookcases, wondering what kinds of porn she might keep around in a place like this. But aside from a handsome edition of Desaad, she must have kept it all hidden away, for most of her more prominent tomes were simply standard occult works, such as von Jundt's infamous Unaussprechlichen Kulten, or Unspeakable Cults, which the editor of Weird Tales magazine once ironically misinterpreted as unpronounceable cults. She also owned copies of Derleth's horrid Cults des Ghouls, Prynne's ghastly De Vermis Mysteris, and, most abominable of all, Alhazred's forbidden and unpleasantly erudite Necronomicon. All in all, a pretty typical library for an occultist living in quasi-Lovecraftian space-time. There were also a lot of novels, and not very surprisingly, a complete set of Lovecraft in handsome Arkham House volumes, as well as in moldering paperbacks. Bella Madonna finally returned, wearing considerably less and carrying a decorative tray of drinks and what looked like drugs. I still half wanted food, but her brief and provocative outfit started my mouth watering for confections of a different sort than my usual drab diet. Goblinhood, meanwhile, was practically creaming his jeans from looking at the lush white flesh of her ass surrounding a skimpy thong-type garment. Her buttocks quivered invitingly, and we could barely keep from salivating in Pavlovian fashion. I wondered if she was wagging her tail around in my face because she wanted us to have sex, and I really hoped that would turn out to be the case, but I took pains to try and hide my thoughts, wondering just how telepathic she might turn out to be. 6. Either she was very telepathic indeed, or she could tell simply from observation that I wouldn't be making any bull moves, because she was singularly at ease with me. And for all I knew, her silken G-string, fishnet stockings, high-heeled boots, and leather jacket were common everyday houseware around here, or were even some kind of exclusive high fashion. And so, to avoid embarrassing myself, I tried to keep my mind on rotting jackal carcasses and other wholesome, non-sexual thoughts. She seemed vaguely sardonic as she set her tray down on a small table near the cushions I was sitting on, but I'm not exactly sure just how this attitude was conveyed. Pseudo-Lovecraftian gibberish aside, unless it was through a subtle twist of her lips or a significant glitter in her eyes, for I now finally noticed, finally tearing my eyes away from her voluptuous ass, that she'd covered most of her face up with a mask of her own, and to my surprise, it also seemed to represent a spider, just as Goblinhood's did, though quite different in aspect. Was it possible that G.H. had somehow blundered into some kind of sartorial coup without knowing it? Only in a small way, she startlingly responded to my unvoiced inquiry. It turned out that she was the head of some kind of gang of female weirdos or coven of self-professed witches or something who called themselves the Black Widows, and that this was part of their ceremonial garb being shown off for me. I couldn't resist comparing spiders with you, she chuckled, but I'm surprised you didn't notice it right away. I'm, not very observant, I managed to get out. Oh, say, is that coffee? I chirped then to change the subject. Yes, I could tell you wanted some, she replied. I also brought something good to smoke. She then handed me a pipe, which I toked heavily on, hoping to mellow out those old testosterone levels a bit. 7. 8. 9. 10. Nayadar psych pet? Eh? I gaped stupidly, staring in what seemed like it might be her direction. God damn, what a rush. The Hope. Biped. Pau Zulu. Bike kit. Everything was a stately twirling pavane of quarks, leptons, and others of their ilk, loaded with charm, as the room? Was that what this was called? It sounded right. And God told Adam to name all the animals and stuff, or else. Somewhere in Genesis. But even that didn't help in the end. It did. As the, yes, room slowly took shape again around me, I noticed vaguely that my charming hostess seemed amused, and she'd been the most scintillating feature of the subatomic display, hands down. I said, she stressed once again, and then very slowly and carefully pronounced, "How do you like this swell dope? Hey, are you okay?" "Okay. Yeah, the dope. Wow, I just... Jeepers, the dope. That's right. But this is no ordinary dope, if I'm not mistaken. This is fucking kick-ass dope." And I was still feeling it. "Cannabis Majestica," she smirked, taking another big hit and passing the pipe back to me. "Huh?" I asked, wondering if my ears were going wacky again as I fumbled for a moment in my bag. "Cannabis Majestica," she repeated. "Was that it? That Martian weed they grew in Heinlein's book, The Number of the Beast. Or maybe you never read it." I'd seen it on her shelf, and of course I'd read it. A landmark work in the alternate reality subgenre, for all its folly, and an absolute scream to read if you approach it the right way. Read it? Hell, I've referenced it. It's become crucial to the overall mythos of my esteemed friend and brainchild, Goblinhood. I don't remember what that dope was called, and I'd hate to have to look it up, I commented, carefully arranging Goblinhood and his little buddies on the cushion beside me. There were only a couple of direct references to it in the whole novel, and I mean, the book's a riot and all that, but a reviewer once said, quite correctly, that all that military-type gibberish in the middle was like fording a river of shit. I broke up and howled with laughter. Boy, I love really shitty reviews about other people's work, I cackled, especially about artists or works that I like, as long as it isn't really hurting them, and as long as the reviews are funny and not just poisonous. And anyway, Heinlein survived that one and went on to write Job. I lit the pipe again, this time toking a little more carefully. The sweet smoke tasted like sun-drenched fields on an endless summer afternoon. "Yeah, I think I read that review. Heavy metal, wasn't it? Hey, those are cute. Meet the Renegade Club," I coughed and sputtered, holding it in as best I could while I smoked with my friends. "The Renegade Club? Don't ask me. That was a little number cooked up by the Suitcase and Cosmic Weevil dolls a few weeks back when GH tried to take over the group by calling it the Goblinhood Gang. Obviously, the Suitcase Mob and the Cosmic Weevil Bunch were also out of the question, so they all grudgingly settled on the Renegade Club, which they all grudgingly agreed was sort of big time. I suddenly remembered that Maya was also part of the group and was still carefully folded up in the duffel bag along with various accessories, so I brought Maya out to join in the festivities, fully dressed, of course, to the sardonic mirth of Bella Madonna, who looked as if she wanted to sign up for membership when I let her handle the smaller dolls, fragile as they're getting to be by now, Hell, we all are, aren't we? I am. Do these have names? She asked, enchanted, I'm sure. I told her the names and introduced Maya into the bargain. Goblinhood you've already met, sometimes known as the Warlock of Mars, I added, poking again and passing it. I was glad the little ritual ceremony among the Renegade Club was over, because the pot was really fucking my head, and I didn't want any outstanding responsibilities while it did. Maybe it was some spiffy kind of great weed, or maybe I just hadn't had any since the goddamn fucking so-called drug war started revving up back yonder. Either way, I was totally cooked, and getting even more so. Bella Madonna, meanwhile, had come over and squatted in front of me to fiddle with her stereo equipment. The pungent, intoxicating fragrance of her ass faintly reached me, firing me as I clandestinely admired the hang of her cheeks, like bladders or toy balloons filled with exotic pomegranates or something, as the biblical Song of Solomon might have said if it had been as magnificently trashed as I currently was. I wondered again in a dopey sort of way if there were any chance of having sex with her. At least she hadn't kicked me out as yet. I see you like to read, I commented, picking a safe mutual interest for a conversational gambit, and decided that it wasn't just the smoke. There was actually something very strange about this woman. You bet. Hope you don't mind some music. She sat back down while 200 Motels started playing. And of course I didn't mind. But that was another thing. Why Zappa and the Mothers of Invention? Why that particular piece? Coincidence or definitely something really weird? Well, at least we could still talk over the music, and I marshaled my forces. But she struck first. Does your spider have anything to do with Ziggy Stardust? She meant Goblinhood Spider on his mask. Nah, well, maybe, subliminally or peripherally. I really liked most of Bowie's stuff, from Space Oddity to Diamond Dogs, and the Spiders from Mars album was an early favorite. As for the mask, most people figure it for a reference to Spider-Man or even Santo, or they just make GR as a bank robber or a terrorist. But actually, the spider symbolizes a bunch of stuff, including the fact that I think spiders get a pretty raw deal, image-wise, considering how harmless and even useful most of them are. So, Goblinhood wears it in solidarity with them. Ha ha. This from a notorious arachnophobe. But true enough, as far as it goes. The Martian connection? I continued. You'll have to ask G.H. about that. But I can tell you that it has more to do with that book there. I pointed at her Necronomicon, the 1977 Schlang Craft, Inc., /Avon Books edition, edited and introduced by, quote, Simon, unquote. Bogus as hell, no doubt, but weird and dangerous enough in its own way. Of the various nefarious versions, this was the only one I'd ever seen, much less read. And perhaps there truly is a real version out there somewhere, but I'm not so sure I think I'd ever want to actually encounter its eldritch hoariness and so on, if you get my drift. I mean, come on. Meanwhile, the dope was really coming on now, and especially playing hell with my time sense. I hoped I could keep it together during what was looking to be a long and confusing literary gab fest, but she was acting stoned too, and very definitely indefinably and provocatively weird as hell, and damned if she didn't have a weird tale, or at least a bewitching one. I was certainly bewitched, and Goblinhood was literally beside himself. So much for testosterone levels, but maybe that didn't count with this magic Marcin weed or whatever it was called. Page 28, I said helpfully, while she leafed through her copy. Not the prestigious $50 first edition, I noted. She passed her ornate little pipe again, but I actually begged off this time, for once. I was still progressively buzzing further and further out, getting so high it almost scared me. And she had a whole bag full of this stuff. Maybe it was easier to get a hold of around here, but in any case, she clearly wouldn't be stalking the Wily Roach for some time to come. And if this load didn't slow down, I wasn't sure I'd ever even want to or need to again. It just kept on trucking. Bella had reached page 28, the part about the Marcin Zoni. The concise little statement about my old pal, Nurgle. You mean Goblinhood actually encountered this being? She asked wonderingly. Sort of. I once wrote a quasi-epic poem about it, I boasted, squirming with languid pleasure as the dope accelerated its assault and Strictly Genteel started playing in the background. But had there really been enough time passing for the double album set to reach its end? I hadn't even seen her turn it over. And actually, the poem was supposedly about Billy the Kid, but probably not enough to really fool anybody. Sounds like the battle of the century, she snickered. Tell me about it if it isn't classified or something. Not half sarcastic, but I also thought she really wanted to hear. And so I tried with as much coherence as I could muster amidst the rising tide of confused and ecstatic disorientation to tell her the long and very complicated story, which didn't even make all that much sense when I was straight. And after all, it was the same old story, wasn't it? An unbalanced, eccentric, but essentially well-meaning artist meddles with a forbidden book, just playing, goddammit, pretending to actually be part of the Lovecraft mythos. Hell, where's the harm? But the harm lay in the fact that Goblinhood apparently seemed to have inadvertently gotten himself actually mixed up with a real entity of some sort while he painted his idea of the thing's image. His conception, based on the book's description, was derived from the Sphinx creature in the Wheel of Fortune card from the illustrious Wade Rider Tarot designed by Pamela Coleman Smith in 1909. Perhaps, however, the use of real pictures of the real Marcin Sphinx for purposes of creating verisimilitude in the finest Lovecraftian tradition, maybe that did the trick. Anyway, next thing you know, matters were getting to be a bit of a sticky wicket, and it took G.H. and me almost 2 years to come up with a protective sigil, the one above the spider on the mask, which made the pesky bugger go away, or at least made it leave us alone. For what it's worth, all this started in August of 1986, the year Whitley Strieber was mostly talking about in communion, and it didn't begin to end until the big harmonic convergence, which took place about a year later. Even then, Goblinhood didn't know that it was over, didn't even realize what exactly had happened, until yet another year later. The whole mess had scared him so badly that he'd virtually occluded it from his mind. But in August of 1988, while we were reading a randomly purchased comic book in which an occult protagonist actually had to battle a largely hidden and clandestine demon named, interestingly enough, Nurgle, the memory, the awareness, was slowly, finally triggered. That was when G.H. and I painted our harmless Marcin sigil, created earlier that year for our Millennium painting, into the 1986 painting that had originally gotten us kicked out of the Einsteinian space-time continuum. And that was the end of that, so far. 11. To my delight, Bella Madonna at least pretended to believe me, and we got to talking about this particular Necronomicon manifestation, and about Lovecraft, and about the mythos in general. We both agreed that this version seemed kind of bastardized, or at least watered down. For all its interdimensional angst, the Nurgle affair had been pretty Mickey Mouse when you came right down to it. Nobody really even got hurt, just hassled and haunted, and that by something which barely even seemed to be there, except when it was going bump in the night. A situation, in fact, distinguishable from the usual disaster that is my life, only by an expert like me. Fortunately, no lasting harm was done, and all in all, it was the kind of thing one can even laugh about years later. Ha ha. I guess G.H. was mostly just freaked out at the time about getting tossed out of an entire continuum for the first time that he could remember. No, these were more like the little brothers of the great old ones, or not even that. This was more the kind of Cthulhu mythos that could be obtained from a cereal box or a gumball machine. At any rate, I was comfortable with the belief system as it stood, and if the real entities truly existed anywhere, I was pretty sure I didn't know if I really thought I even wanted to be aware of it, or whatever. I was still getting to be awfully, awfully stoned just then, and there seemed to be no end in sight. But then, it was kind of fun, you know? Did you know that William Burroughs invoked these same Schlangenkraft entities at the beginning of Cities of the Red Night? She asked. And there it was again. Of course I knew. And I couldn't figure out just why that was so weird. It was like deja vu or something. Or maybe I was even having a flashback of some kind, and it was getting under my skin. On that stuff, anything was possible. Did you catch those tennis shoe commercials he was in? She chortled. Yeah, yeah, I laughed too, I admitted, passionately hating tennis shoe commercials and everything they stood for. But hey, I continued, staunchly and loyally defending him, the guy's old and probably needs the bread. And he wrote Naked Lunch. Come to think of it, I wonder if the commercial vampires who signed him up had ever even read any of his stuff. It seemed unlikely. All this somehow segued into a discussion of funny bad reviews and semi-embarrassing gaffes on the part of the literary great, and of critics especially, for some reason. And I got to tell her the one about Colin Wilson, H.P. Lovecraft, the Vampire of Dusseldorf, and the Marquis de Sade, which, for a wonder, she hadn't stumbled across as yet, unless she was just humoring me. I kept forgetting that she was a little bit telepathic. But I was on a roll anyway, ripped to the tits and rolling along faster and further all the time, and enjoying it. Anyway, it seems that Colin Wilson, a British writer, once wrote a book called The Strength to Dream, Literature and the Imagination, published once upon a time in 1962 by Houghton Mifflin Co. in Boston. And it seems that Wilson, in this book, actually compared Lovecraft to Peter Curtin, the notorious so-called Dusseldorf vampire, an early 20th century German thrill killer and serial killer, a molester and mangler of children, a monster, in other words, the guy that Peter Lorre played with such force in Fritz Lang's classic film M, the criminal that even the underworld wanted caught, to get the heat off and out of sheer disgust. Furthermore, it seems that once upon a time, Colin Wilson, in that same book, had something very like this to say, and I quote from memory. With the exception of Lovecraft, no writer ever tried harder than de Sade to conjure up the powers of darkness. With the exception of Lovecraft, no writer made himself more absurd. Good point there, I guess, in a way. But talk about absurd, I mean, it is to howl. Wilson later recanted, and unlike Galileo, he seems to have meant it, because he started writing Cthulhu mythos stories himself. Return of the Loigor was pretty good. I haven't yet read The Space Vampires, which might not even be mythos related, but there exists a really hilarious pillory job on it in the book Orbit 19, edited by Damon Knight and published by Harper and Row in 1977. Look it up. The entire book is highly recommended, but the Wilson roast is a gem. And yet I'd still like to track down The Space Vampires just to be a completist, or hell, just for something funny to read. And though Bella Madonna didn't see fit to question me on this point, I've often wondered why I so enjoy seeing Lovecraft castigated in print, despite my love of his work, as when the once eminent critic Edmund Wilson sneered at him for trying to scare people with an invisible whistling octopus. But the fact is, you can't enjoy admiring Lovecraft unless you can develop a sense of humor about it, due to his unabashed ethnocentrism, or just plain racism, and to various other politically incorrect solecisms and faux pas. Actually, everybody on the planet tends to be ethnocentric and chauvinistic, but it's only called racism if a white male like Lovecraft does it, for some reason. Anyway, he was no Desaad, and he was certainly no Peter Curtin, but it took him most of his life to even begin transcending attitudes which were, let's remember, instilled in him routinely and very sincerely from his early childhood. In fact, most people in his social environment felt exactly the same way about this stuff, and expected everybody else to as well. Yet Lovecraft had actually begun to reject these xenophobic notions when he died in 1937, a remarkable achievement in social evolution, considering that most people tend to go from liberal to conservative as they get older, assuming they can change at all. Perhaps too remarkable, said to some kind of ominous background music, implying a deeper, darker mystery to come. But there is a truly horrible and tragic side to this story, for in spite of his ugly views, it was said by everyone who ever knew him that H.P.L. was a most kind-hearted and gentle man, a person who would never have dreamed of physically hurting anyone. Squeamish, too, I hear. According to his biographer, L. Sprague de Camp, Lovecraft threw mouse traps away rather than have to extricate the little cadavers. He couldn't really afford the mousetrap tax on his budget, but I don't blame him anyway. I once killed a mouse with a sewing machine, and I can tell that it was no joke. I was moving from an apartment, once upon a time, that had been virtually commandeered by mice. They were everywhere, and had even taken to, good Lord, choke, prancing and trotting blithely and obnoxiously past me on their various rounds as I sat, feeling helplessly vulnerable, maybe a few feet, maybe a foot or two away in the bathroom. The fucking little bastards. Anyway, enough was enough. So I put out poison for them. But that just made everything even worse. I'd be downstairs in my basement studio, trying to work, and some fucking mouse would come barreling through at about 4 yards an hour, probably thinking that it was burning up the highway or something. I'd watch it go tentatively lurping over to the good old familiar mouse hole in the corner and pause there, kind of sniffing around bewilderedly, especially at the delicious poison that it had been snarfing down so much of lately, and clamoring for more, and writing eloquent fan letters full of compliments to the chef about. Years later, this incident couldn't help reminding me, sickeningly, of pro-censorship North Carolinian Senator Jesse Helms, his buddies in the tobacco industry, and starving, chain-smoking artists like myself. Anyway, the mouse was suffering, dimly trying to figure out just what exactly had gone so wrong with its spiffy little universe, hopelessly trying to somehow find its way back to those merry, halcyon, carefree days back up yonder in the swell old bathroom of yesteryear. But fat chance, you little jerk, I growl gruffly, but sort of compassionately too. The truth is that I was sickened by its obvious disorientation and dread, and I wished fervently that it would just go away, for God's sake. The sick mouse finally buggered off to some remote locale or another. I don't think it had anything so lofty and pretentious as an actual destination by this time. It was just blundering stupidly, helplessly around, and I was just glad that it had blundered out of sight of my tender conscience. The little prick will probably die and rot inside the walls and draw a lot of flies for the new tenants, I muttered, glad that I was moving soon. But I really didn't give a rat's fucking ass about the new tenants, neighbors who had wanted my apartment and who had done more than the mice had to drive me out of it. The new tenants could eat mouse shit sprinkled over cockroach soup, as far as I was concerned. As for these mice now, it soon came to pass that a funny thing happened to me on a day when I was actually moving my stuff out. Well, not funny, but, you know. I was hauling my mother's old sewing machine out of its storage space in the basement, wondering why I kept lugging this old relic around. As it happens, I stopped before too very long. It was a heavy old piece of junk slowly falling apart inside of its shabby case, but, like sundry other rubbish, I probably kept it around for sentimental reasons. No wonder my place had been triple starred in the travel brochures of the mice, little tourists who could be kinda sentimental themselves. Anyway, one of those diminutive little fellow travelers happened to wander in right about this time, trundling pokily over to that hole, as if his whole fucking life depended on going as slowly as possible. As it happens, I sort of know the feeling. The mouse stopped when it got to the poison and apparently was reminded that the hole wasn't any good anymore, that nothing in the whole fucking world, in fact, was any good anymore for some obscure reason that it had probably had right on the tip of its tongue at one time, a reason that no longer seemed to make any difference. Or maybe it did. Or maybe it was just too complicated to think about anymore, even to whatever extent a mouse could be said to think in the first place instead of just to hurt. And it was hurting. It sat there by the renegade hole for what seemed like a while, planning out the lightning swift strategy of its next bold move, no doubt, or just feeling every cell in its body wishing that it was all better now. And it left the dread to me this time around because I suddenly knew exactly what it was going to do. I'd seen them do this before. My flesh crawled. Eventually, the defeated little creature, which hadn't done anything wrong except simply to have been born a mouse, turned slowly, painfully around and began zooming deliriously straight at me, more or less, at what must have seemed like a pretty fair clip, if not breakneck speed, breaking the wound barrier at mock nothing whatsoever. Not a very healthy pace, any road, as I stood there watching and mounting horror. "Just go away and stay away," I barked loudly, hoping to scare it into changing its course, hoping to avoid my terrible responsibility. But it couldn't take a hint, or it was past caring, because I didn't scare it into changing its course at all. Instead, it crept and swayed relentlessly toward its tormentor, the oppressor, as if it knew exactly where it was going and why, as if we both knew, which I certainly did anyway. I just wished that I could have risen better to the occasion, a not uncommon wish for me. For what seemed like an eternity, the dying mouse made a sort of a sluggish, drunken beeline in the direction of a final showdown called destiny, and when it got to me it just stopped and waited, as if it had done all that it could do and was leaving the rest up to me, as if it was really sorry now about that little spot of bother in the bathroom a while back, that little misunderstanding, like a hapless, guilty child nailing up a brightly colored stocking in hopes that Santa Claus would fill it with mercy overnight.